You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
And this is a special version of the THE podcast called Entertaining Thoughts. We're going to look at some of the more provocative headlines over the past year that have kept higher education issues in the national news agenda. And then I'm going to ask our panelists to tell us what they do if they were a minister for a day. We're going to have a couple of mini debates if we've got some time. And then I'm going to ask them to do some future gazing. So first off, I'll start by introducing our panel. We have Mary Kernick Cook, who I'm sure you all know. She's the former CEO of UCAS. We've got Pamela Gillies, back by popular demand from the past, from the panel just before, VC of Glasgow Caledonian University. We've got Nick Hillman, director of the Higher Education Policy Institute. And we've got Chloe Teer, who is a psychology student at Leeds Trinity University and a disability activist. So to start off, full disclosure, I gave our panelists a few headlines for them to and bring to our discussion. So I'm going to start off with that.
So my headline is a humdinger. Bentley driving vice chancellor pockets £66,000 pay rise. Bolton's heads pay rose by almost 30% despite ministers' call for salary restraint. So, to summarise, most of us in the sector do actually deliver restraint in this context. Honestly, we do. But there are a few exceptions to that rule. And they, as I said, they're humdingers, you know. In this particular article, this fellow vice-chancellor was perhaps led astray to equate success with wealth. I think he was led astray. He's hugging his Bentley, and he talks about his yachts. They may, of course, have come from his mum or dad. We don't know. But from a Calvinistic Scottish perspective, even if you had a Bentley, you wouldn't hug it in the Times Higher, would you? So probably ill-advised from his director of communications to engage. He also had visited the President's Club charity over many, many years, and he commented latterly, he wasn't quite sure about the way the young girls who were serving him were treated. So I think it's an unfortunate article. I think it's very, very topical. I think we have to lead the sector in showing restraint. We would urge our chairs of court to engage in the debate, to demonstrate how transparently vice-chancellor's pay is actually dealt with. Certainly in my university, it's very, very transparent. And I'm very clear, I don't want any basic pay increases or performance-related pay. But I think it behoves us to take a lead and perhaps make sure this kind of article doesn't seep into the public domain.
That, Pamela, and I think you hit on some of the more personal points and particularities of that specific case of the Vice Chancellor of the University of Bolton. But it is a wider issue that the sector has been facing and certainly has been in headlines a lot. But I'd actually like to go to you, Chloe, as our token student on the panel, to hear your thoughts. I mean, is this a topic that even trickled down to your friend group or among your friends? Was the topic of conversation around how much your Vice Chancellor makes?
I think it's a topic that we think about, but not a topic that we necessarily get a lot of information about. So I think in that respect, maybe we would like a bit more information on it. But I think, broadly speaking, we are more probably interested in what the university does for us. And I think we should be interested in the pay. But like I said, it's not like the article never, you know, kind of got to student level. I don't know whether that's just me and my group or whether that's more broadly speaking.
Okay. Should we go on to another headline? Nick?
Well, you've given me three. The first one you gave me was universities which no platform controversial speakers will face government intervention, which has a nice sort of sting in the tail, I guess. But it got me thinking, first of all, about my own student days in Manchester, where I first got interested in higher education policy, I guess, as a student union officer at Manchester University Students' Union. In the late 80s, it was Margaret Thatcher resigned in my first term at university. So free speech issues were topical then. The big issue then was whether David Irving books should be on the shelves in the library, but the same sort of issues come round and round again. I was the victim myself of a student union board game where there was a board counter that said FTW on it, and with my photo on it. I asked, why is the Student Union board game got my photo on the Student Union board game? And I was told this. I'm not sure I'm allowed to say the words, but let's say the first word was effing, the second word was Tory, and the third word started with a W. So Student Union politics were quite raw even in those days. But it's an interesting article because there's a lot of nonsense written about free speech issues in university, and we at HEPI have tried to get under the skin of that a bit by doing a survey of students on what they really think about free speech issues, which the conclusion was they're just very confused, I think. And secondly, by trying to provide guidance to universities for their codes of practice on free speech, which are mandatory in England, not in Scotland. But just a couple of things on that. I do think, because it's really an article about Sam Gyimah's threats to universities, and a lot of people in the room might disagree with me on this, but where I think he is onto something, even though there's a lot of nonsense talk about free speech, is on the monoculture in universities. And we ran, for example, a very interesting blog from someone in the Political Studies Association trying to explain why political scientists in the UK HE sector mispredicted the result of the 2015 general election, which was a Conservative majority, but they didn't predict that, mispredicted the result of the 2016 US presidential election, and mispredicted the result of the Brexit referendum. That is a pretty poor record, if we're honest. And the argument from the person who wrote a blog for us, and it's on our website, you can see, was that the political scientists who work with the data were too much in a bubble among people who wanted a different result to the one that actually came about. And my final comment on this, because I'm a governor now, I think the University of Manchester, where I started my remarks, got so fed up with me saying the teaching hadn't been good enough when I've been a student there, that they said, well, why don't you join our board? So I'm now on the board of the University of Manchester. And one of the interesting things that's happened there is a change in the attitude of students towards prevent since the Manchester bombing, the Manchester Arena bombing. And the student union, this sort of dissipated all the opposition of prevent because there were students in that bomb attack who, you know, were personally affected. And it's been really interesting because on campus in Manchester, it has changed the attitude towards prevent. So the free speech debate in Manchester now takes place almost with prevent as something that's just widely accepted across the campus, which for me I found really interesting.
Culture that you're speaking about is something that John Curtis was talking about a little bit today in his inaugural address. Pamela, I'm wondering if you'd like to respond to that about the monoculture that exists on campuses. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't think I would agree with that at all. I think we have very diverse cultures in our universities, to be perfectly frank. I'm not concerned about free speech on our campus. I think we provide many, many platforms for our students, especially student-led conversation and discussion. So, I don't think so.
Right.
But isn't free speech different to monoculture?
Well, it's part of it, though. Part of it.
Maybe we'll save that for a mini debate after we get through our headlines. Mary, what have you got for us?
So am I allowed to slightly break the rules? Because you gave me an article about unconditional offers.
I did.
Of course, unconditional offers has been all over the press today because there's been a major new report published by my old organisation, UCAS, and it doesn't make for pleasant reading for the sector, I don't think. About a quarter of all, and this is school leaver applicants, because obviously if you're an older applicant, you're more likely to have done your qualifications and get an unconditional offer. About a quarter of them now are getting unconditional offers. And there's a couple of things. You know, when I was at UCAS, this was a growing issue, even though I left a year and a half ago, that we'd started looking at. And when I was talking to directors of admissions, you know, the times I heard people say to me, we're going to have to do it because our competitors are doing it. And what would happen in the cycle was that their students would ring up and say, well, University X has given me an unconditional offer. Why? Wouldn't you do the same for me? And so this, you know, it's a marketing tactic, and it's had a ripple effect that has rippled out, and you can see it when you look geographically, that it started the first university to do it with Birmingham in 2013. It rippled out in the West Midlands, and then it went to kind of the Northeast, and then there's pockets rippling out. So I'm afraid I don't really... believe some of the stories from I think Portsmouth was saying today that we definitely all our students get their grades and we're doing it for reasons of stopping stress and so on. Well, I think Bart Spar, who came out with a version of it recently where they said they're going to do all unconditional offers and pay people 750 quid instead if they get their grades. And, you know, with the best will in the world, these are marketing tactics. And they're marketing tactics for universities who are struggling to get enough students to grow their student body at a time when the population of 18-year-olds is going down. Speaking to schools, as I still do and used to do even more, they loathe it because it takes out of their control how they're dealing with their pupils. And, you know, whatever you think about it, it can't be right or fair when, you know, in a class of, let's say, 30 sixth formers, you know, 15 of them have got unconditional offers, and the rest haven't, for reasons that are opaque to both the teacher who's trying to kind of manage and keep them motivated, but also to the students themselves. So I'm afraid that I actually think the best thing, which, and I've said this, I think, on a Happy blog, I think there needs to be a gentleman's agreement amongst, a gentle folks agreement amongst vice-chancellors, just to stop doing it, because people are, more and more people are doing it because to keep up with the others, and it'll blow itself out as a marketing tactic if everybody does it, and then we'll all be worse off, and the OFS will pile in, and Sam Jima will make, you know, more unflattering comments. So I really think we should just quietly stop from the 2019 cycle onwards.
I hear what you're saying about it being a marketing tactic, but some people have also said that this is a way for them to widen access to get to students who might not perform as well in these certain types of assessments. Another issue to this, though, is that it is helping people be more competitive in a marketized environment. So what would you say to that? What would be the alternative to the unconditional offer?
Well, you know, on the widening participation side, you know, I wish we saw universities giving contextual offers, you know, to 25% of the students who in polar quintile 1 and 2. It seems they're dishing out a higher proportion of unconditional offers, and that's probably another competitive response to the fact that they're under pressure to get better widening participation data to satisfy I was going to say offer, now it's OFS. So I think that's just a smoke screen. And, you know, really, if that's the best marketing tactic that the university sector can come up with, then, you know, it needs to get some marketing equity, PDQ.
All right, Chloe, what have you got for us?
So one of the headlines I got was around mental health within universities and about how more emphasis needs to be put on the universities to, you know, meet the demands of students. University is no longer just about teaching. It is about empowering the students to do their best and providing that emotional support as well. And obviously in recent years, the mental health difficulties within students are rising. So we need to meet the demand, really.
How have you felt that your university has extended that support to your fellow students?
I think it will vary massively on universities, but I do think there needs to be some level playing field in terms of every student gets the support they require, because otherwise you're going to have, you know, groups of people who are underperforming through no fault of their own.
I would like to ask the panel just broadly about this. I mean, the mental health crisis is something we're hearing a lot about, but I don't know, is that something that's being blown out of proportion like the crisis on free speech, or is this something that is really front of mind for you, Pamela?
It's a real problem, and it is front of mind, and keeping our students safe is something, that's the one thing that keeps me awake at night. And it's not just about young people in crisis. Those are the ones we hear about in the newspapers. We need better connections with the NHS, universities and the NHS, to be able to deal with people in clinical crisis. And those are terrible tragedies. But there's a real problem with increased anxiety and depression and a lack of well-being across a large swathe of the student body. So we have a huge spectrum that we're going to have to deal with. And simply investing in counsellors at one end isn't going to solve the problem of Chloe. It's too light, almost, that we do need to address this through personal tutoring, mental health training for staff who are really at the forefront of meeting students on a regular basis. That's academic and support staff. So this is a big investment that's required and a change in culture. It's a very real problem.
I completely agree with that we need to do more in the prevention space. And clearly, when people are in extreme distress, then you know there are actions that you have to take. But I think this whole thing about student engagement and well-being is something that universities can do, and they can do purposefully and actively to make sure that there's no students who are left out of friendship groups, of social groups, of societies, out of actually going to their classes and so on. And there are ways that universities can act and support students to flourish at university and not spiral down into extreme stress, distress, anxiety, depression, and worst of all, suicide, as we read about too often.
Nick?
Well, I agree with everything that's been said. I'll just say two things. One is, we have to remember mental health is different to physical health in one respect, and that is its incidence is greatest when you're young. So most physical ailments, you're more likely to have the older you are. Mental health, there's those ages between about 16 and about 24 where they typically first show themselves. So, of course, it's a big issue for universities because that's the age of a lot of the students they're educating. So it's incredibly important. And we've written, as you know, various reports about this. One thing that strikes me from our reports on it, because I'm no expert on mental health, I just try to follow the evidence. And the evidence is this. It seems to be an issue, unlike lots of issues we come across, where some universities have cracked it. So it really is an issue that some universities do know how to support their students really well. And it is one of those issues where the universities that have problems, you know, the very first thing to do is just to learn from those that are doing it much better. It's partly about money. And we heard in the previous Vice Chancellor's question time session, if the fee cap in England were to be significantly reduced, mental health support and some of those important student support services might be the thing that would go first. So we just need to remember that as well.
Have you got any examples of universities that have cracked it?
Well, the report that we wrote, well, it was a student who wrote it for us called Poppy Brown, who's now a PhD student. And she was an undergraduate at the time. She thought some of the initiatives at York were fantastic. Cohen Lambert has now moved on, of course, to Sheffield. But it was really led from the Vice-Chancellor there. We had a very good flowchart from Leeds, where Leeds staff who didn't know what to do, but they knew a student was in trouble, have a really good flowchart that signposts the academic or the support staff towards, you know, tells them what to do. So that's two examples.
Great, thanks for that. Headlines, who's got another one for us? Pamela?
Scottish university staff get sexual violence reporting cards. And this was from as a result of a campaign from Fiona Druitt, who was the mother of Emily Druitt, who sadly was an Aberdeen University student who took her own life as a result of sexual violence from her boyfriend. And her mother really just wanted to raise awareness of gender violence. And it's part of the mental health state of our young people as well, that gender violence is very real. It can have traumatic consequences. And what this campaign is about is just an awareness raising for every single member of staff in Scottish universities, from the domestic staff in the accommodation suite or the university, right up to, we call them the high hegians like me or the top professors. Everybody is aware, but this is only part of the toolkit that as universities we must all use. And I think there are a number of universities in Scotland that have, you know, very strong campaigns to raise this issue really to the forefront of people's attention. We have a campaign called Erase the Grey. So there's a campaign banner that our students actually create. It's not okay if I've been drinking. And the not is in grey, because an awful lot of our young female students say, well, it's okay, I was beaten up because I was drinking. So it's about raising those grey areas and tackling this difficult issue head on.
Mary?
I was just going to say that I was lucky to read Graham Towle and Tammy Walker's book that's been published recently about sexual assault on campus. And it's a really good tour, not just this country, but Canada, Australia, other countries as well. It's highly prevalent in universities. It's mostly men against women, but not exclusively. Reporting is one of the big issues. Really low levels of reporting. And Graham and Tammy both feel that that's one of the things that has to be tackled, because it's only with reporting that we know more about it and can do something about it. And the one thing I just wanted to mention that I picked up from the book is that some universities are worried about reputational risk if they start reporting sexual violence. And I think some of the case studies there showed that actually transparency about the university's concern about this issue actually is a reputational boost and not the opposite. Yeah. So I think there's some really good points to pick up.
Fantastic. Nick, can you give us another headline?
Yes, yeah, so I've got one about future demand for higher education places, which is from, if I recall correctly, from the Times Higher itself. Fantastic magazine. Demand for 300,000 new university places threatens uncapped system. And I'm glad you chose this one, because the number is from a HEPI report, and the article's about a HEPI report. And we did something very simple. We just looked at the number of people who were born in England. Most of the figures are England. There's lessons, too, for other parts of the UK. 18 years ago, hence how many 18-year-olds are there around today. And then we looked at the participation rate, which has been growing, and assume that graph just continued. And if you do those two things, and you lop off a few places that are lost because of Brexit, with fewer EU students coming here, then you find you get to a number, 300,000 extra places necessary in the system by 2030. I hope Sam Gyimah understands this, because the paper was co-authored by Diana Beach, who's now his advisor. So I hope they do. And I think it's profound for a number of reasons. One is, it tells us that whatever the Augar review comes to, if one of the recommendations is putting student number caps back on, in my view, it would be a disaster, because you'll be putting them back on at the point you need the places. Just remember, our primary schools and secondary schools are literally full to bursting. I'm the governor of one that's just doubled in size. So we mustn't put number caps on. I would do almost anything before I put number caps back on, including we must avoid having a minimum entry tariff, because some of the very poorest students who benefit most from higher education are the ones who enter with low qualifications but go on to great success. And then the final thing I'll say, we had a very conservative assumption in that report. So we didn't assume the entry rate of young men matches the entry rate of young women. We didn't assume the entry rate of people from the poorest households comes to match the entry rate of people from the richest households. And if you do any of those things, you need at least 500,000 places but extra in the system by 2030. So it's why I've called for a 70% target for higher education participation, because I think if we set a target, we can have a path to the target rather than getting there by accident and in a sort of wavy way. It got me some of the best abuse I've ever had online when I've suggested a 70% higher education participation, but I stand by it.
Pamela, I'm wondering if you want to put that into a Scottish context for us at all. Is that something that you're paying attention to as well?
I absolutely, and I completely agree with you, because the OECD data shows that the higher the proportion of young people in our higher education or further education, the more prosperous, innovative, productive our societies are, but we will always be limited by funding available. So we don't have any fees in Scotland. We have great commitment from the government to keep funding higher education at the level it is at the moment. But to expand it, how can we expand it with the current funding models, either in England or in Scotland? Because frankly, I don't think they're sustainable. We need to look at new ways of funding higher education, working perhaps in a different way with industry.
Okay, do you want to expand on that a little bit, or should I move on? Working with industry?
Well, if we are committed to co-creating the kind of certificates, diplomas, degrees that industry needs, whether it's the railway industry, big energy industry, we will be creating different kinds of offers from the offers we take off the shelf at the moment. but they may be more relevant for industry's needs. They may be more willing to pay, as they are in Africa, because they're working with us in Africa to do this. And that keeps everything going at a higher level.
I just wanted to add one other factor, which is graduate mothers. So graduate mothers is highly correlated with likelihood of their children going to university. And of course, around this time that Nick's calculations come up with an extra 300,000, we've also seen a huge expansion in the number of the proportion of women who have degrees, and they're getting to the age when their children will be becoming 18. And actually, I think when you add that in, it probably looks more like 600,000. Yeah. But as Nick said, they modelled basic on today's trends, but there could be an awful lot more.
Fantastic. Chloe, have you got a headline for us?
So another headline that I was given was about the university strikes and students wanting to claim back the teaching that was missed. So it was about 14 days of teaching that was missed across the strikes, and students wanted their money back. So initially this started at student union level and went up higher and actually led to some legal cases for students to claim back because of the, you know, we pay £9,250 a year for the degree, and with the timings of strikes, it was before a lot of major deadlines, it was the beginning of the year, you know, it was what some people described as a vital time. They needed the teaching and support.
So from what you're saying, I get the impression that you would agree with these students asking for their tuition fees back for that time.
I think I would, and I think a vast majority of other students would agree with me. I know that universities did their best to implement teaching around the strike and to kind of make it at a level so they would still have, you know, the best chance to pass these assignments. But I think it is, you know, there's no way to say
well, no, because I agree. And not everybody in the room might agree, but I do agree. I think once you've gone to a heavily fee-based system, you know, whether you should or not is a different question. Once you've gone to a heavily fee-based system, then I think it changes the dynamics, actually. And therefore, I think students have a right to know where their fees are going. I'm trying to avoid a self-advert for a report we did on that issue last week. They have a right to know where their fees are going, and what they did, though, those students who asked for a refund, was the wrong calculation. They assumed that every penny of their 9250 was just going on the lecture time. If they were sitting in a library when their lecture had been cancelled, they're still in the university facilities. So the calculation, the way they did the calculation was wrong, but the principle I actually accept.
And I think it's sad that we're treating students as customers, or they see themselves as customers rather than part of our academic community, Chloe, because and I think that's because of the fees-based system. So I agree, I can understand why it happened, but perhaps we need a different kind of conversation around these issues.
No, nothing particularly to add to what other people have said.
Okay. Is this microphone okay? Yeah? Okay. For in the matter of time, should we move on now? I've given our panelists another assignment, which was to think about what they would do if they were minister for a day and to not be too constrained by the 24 hours in a day. Who would like to start? Mary?
First off, I definitely wouldn't accept. I would demand at least 5 years contract, because one day would definitely not be enough. So I was trying to think what to pick. I was thinking about credit, and then I read the website of Lambda School in the US, and it says there, instead of paying tuition fees, students at Lambda School agree to pay a percentage of their income once they're earning over $50,000. If you don't find a job or reach that level, you'll never pay a cent. And I thought, that's pretty much what we do here. And I thought, why don't we frame it like that? And instead, we've allowed this combination of lazy headlines and sentiment to get into this language of loans and debt, and which I think is incredible. incredibly negative. So if I were minister for a day, I would change the name of a student loans company and call it student finance company or something. And I would just set about reframing the whole tuition fee deal. For a start, not calling them tuition fees. Nick, I think your report said student fees would be a more appropriate way of thinking about it. And get across this idea that, in essence, leaving aside living costs, university is free at the point of entry for most people, and you don't pay back until you get and keep a job earning over a certain threshold. I also think I would just have a little go at whether universities might share some of the financial consequences if people don't get jobs at the end. And I am a proponent of probably credit-bearing and probably assessed careers education, whatever that might look like, and for that to be compulsory. Because I think if you added that on to the kind of deep learning that people are doing in whatever academic discipline they, you know, sets the light on in their brain, I think that would be incredibly helpful. So that would be my day in office. Busy day.
Pamela, do you want to start off by telling us which minister you've chosen to be and what you would do?
Well, I would want to be Minister for Education because I'm a wee disruptor. And what I would like to do is just redesign the whole education system. I want more money put into preschool, nursery, primary and secondary school education. I want more money into teaching, teacher training, training teachers to be facilitators of learning, problem solvers. I would then create a system which was much more collaborative, where there were seamless pathways between all the little bits of transition points. Because our education system will promote social benefit, it will reduce inequalities if we manage it properly in our society, it will encourage curiosity and creativity, you know, from day one right through into higher education. But I just think it needs a whole systems rethink, and we need to be bold, because we're only tinkering at the margins. A little bit of less fee here, or a little bit of more investment in WP there. Oh, for goodness sake.
You'd go the whole way.
I would.
I'd come and be your...
Could you come and help me on that one?
Right. Yeah. Minister and Vice Minister already settled. Great. Nick?
Thank you. I'd love an hour as Home Secretary just before I became Education Minister.
Okay, we'll allow that.
So that I could change the international student fee. In fact, I would do two things. I would change the all the targets and restrictions and what have you around international students. And I'd also share, I'm going to be very magnanimous as Home Secretary, and in future share my responsibility for international students with the other government departments. And after my hour as Home Secretary, I would then move to the Education Department, and I would try to persuade the Treasury, which would be hard, to reintroduce maintenance grants in England, because I think, although I'm largely a defender of the funding system we've got, I just cannot defend the fact that the poorest entrants emerge with the biggest debts at the end. I think that's completely indefensible. And maybe it will change when the ONS review how it all appears in the national accounts. And then the third thing I'd do, because we mustn't forget research in this conversation, is explain much more clearly than I think government has done to date exactly how we're going to hit the medium-term target of 2.4% of GDP on R&D. And there is a longer-term target that no one ever talks about, 3% of UK GDP on R&D, and I think we need to talk about that.
Another big day. Chloe, what have you thought?
So I'm probably biased in my views in terms of I have a disability, I'm a disability activist, and I think that is what I would spend my time doing, but as a minister, because that probably has more power than I currently have. But higher education should be available to everyone, whether they have a disability, whether they're from an ethnic minority, anything. And I think even if it is physically possible, that doesn't necessarily mean people believe it is an option for them. People might think, oh, if I have a disability, I can't go to university because, you know, it'll be too hard, or there's too many hurdles to go over to get into that step. So if I was minister for a day, I would decrease the extra hurdles and barriers and support people or everyone to get into higher education and to just access education at an equal level in general.
Thanks for that. I think that's a good segue into one of the many debate topics that I also shared with our panel before today, which is about not just widening participation, but making higher education inclusive for every single student. And I'm not talking about just getting enrollments or hitting certain targets. I'm talking about really making environments where people feel that they are welcome, that they've got a space to speak, and they've got a space not to just speak, but to grow and to really have that education experience that they're hoping for. So I guess more than a mini debate, maybe just some thoughts from our panel about how you think that can best be achieved. Nick, do you want to start?
Well, I often think in this context of a conversation I had with a vice chancellor that has, at a university that has a lot of courses in what's called, you know, subjects allied to medicine, so nursing, things like this. And he said to me, the students on his course are very diverse, lots of BME students, for example. And the students, the BME students, were getting in, but then falling behind the white students on the course. Until the point of the course where they go into hospitals and you know, effectively being taught by the hospital staff. He said at that point it all got reversed. And his explanation for that was that the staffing of the hospital looked and felt, in terms of diversity, more like the student body. And they felt more at home and more integrated. And at that point, actually, the BME students overtook the white students. And I know we must appoint academic staff on the basis of excellence and all those sorts of things, but we know from business and all the rest of it that if you put real effort into diversifying your staff, you can make big changes without reducing the quality of staff. And so I have, over the 5 years I've been doing this job, become convinced, you know, when you look at, for example, the black attainment gap after people have got into university, that we do need much more diverse staffing in universities. And actually, I would look at the curricula again as well, which I know when Malia Bhatia, as head of NUS, recommended, it was seen as a really radical idea, and I was surprised to find myself agreeing with her. But on that, I think I do. I think because there's that access point, and then there's the what happens after people have entered, and we need to think about that.
Chloe, what's your response to that? Seeing more diverse staff, but then also changes to the curriculum?
So I think diverse staff will help because it gives students part of who are diverse, those role models, those people to relate to. And also, staff can relate to the students in certain ways as well. And obviously, if you have, we should have diverseness in society, never mind in education. But I think if you facilitate it within education, that in turn means that society becomes diverse because the level of education you are giving is diverse and you will get people in those higher levels of power if you continue.
Pam, any thoughts?
We're known for our widening participation approach, contextualised admissions, but it does start at nursery school. We bring, since 2008, we've brought more than 15,000 nursery, primary and secondary school children into the university to learn basic life skills with our staff and student mentors. And our student peer mentors are tremendous role models for the generations coming up behind them to say, you can really do this, you know. You can go to New York, to our GCU campus in New York, and you can be the, you know, the best in the world at what you do. It doesn't matter if you come from one of the poorest backgrounds or have a chaotic family background, that when you come here, you'll be supported. So having peer mentors who the young people coming in can genuinely relate to is as important, I think, as having a diverse staff group.
I was just going to add to that I really applaud the Scottish, is it called GAP? Is it the Gender Action Plan?
Yes.
Which is about getting more equality between men and women in different subjects, where there are massive gaps on both sides. Obviously, mostly in STEM subjects tend to be slightly more predominantly men. And then as soon as you go over to kind of caring professions, nursing, teaching, social work, etc., it's predominantly women. And so for me, there's something about taking positive action in those subject areas, because of course it also means that the professional staff, or the teaching staff in those subject areas are more likely to be men or women, vice versa. So it would create more diversity through the whole system if we really started to address those gender imbalances. And incidentally, I think it might do something for the gender pay gap as well. And I was reflecting that the fact that STEM, you know, which is kind of the big hard stuff and the higher paid stuff and so on, is predominantly men, you know, that must contribute as well. So I think something around this kind of subject diversity could have a real impact on student support, on the gender pay gap, on gaps in ethnicity and so on. It'd be really interesting to look at as a wider subject.
Yeah, I think any sort of effort to just create a more inclusive environment will have a knock-on effect for all different types of minority groups. We've got just a few minutes left, so we've managed to avoid the B word the whole time that we've been up here for the past 41 minutes, so you're welcome for that respite. But I would like to talk about the future and what's going to happen. We can talk about Brexit, we can talk about no deal, second referendum perhaps. I'd like to hear about potential outcomes of the funding review or anything else that you think is sitting on the horizon for higher education in the next year or 5 years. Who should I start with? Nick, you're looking at me smiling.
All right, okay. Well, I'll talk about something else other than Brexit just to begin with, because there's one thing that is on the horizon that is critically important to the UK, and I do mean UK, HE sector, that none of us are talking about, and we normally would be talking about at this point in the political cycle, and that is next year's comprehensive spending review. And I know how much money, how rich the country is dependent on things like how Brexit goes, but normally at this point in the cycle, we would be preparing as a sector our bids for the next few years of what the education sector needs and what the various different government departments need for the next 3 or 4 years. And as I say, normally at this point in the political cycle, we would be obsessed with it. And I never hear about it talked in the sector, ever. And actually, I think it's going to be really important. On Brexit, my view for a long time has been the sector should call for a second referendum. I sadly missed John. I had some travel transport issues coming here, but I was following what John Curtis said on Twitter. And I was very struck by what he said about how the sector had played their role differently in the Scottish referendum and then the EU referendum. But the fact is, they did play an intervention. First EU referendum, second through the one from the 1970s, now they've gone quiet, and I find that really odd. Everybody knows what the university sector's view is on Brexit and the referendum. HEPI doesn't have a view. We're a charity. We're a non-partisan charity. And I just think they could be have been calling for a second referendum, which I personally, if you think the deal's going to fail in Parliament, which looks increasingly likely, then I personally think a second referendum is more likely than a general election. If you agree with that, and you may not, if you agree with that, why doesn't the sector call for it? And for once, we'll be on the winning side of the argument about a referendum. You know, I don't know what the result will be. I don't know what the question will be. But you'll be on the winning side of the argument there should be a second referendum. Because I think that...
Mary, what is your crystal ball saying?
Well, on Brexit, I'm a little bit, you know, can I phone a friend for advice on this? But I just wanted to reflect a bit on some of the things that Nick was saying and what we heard in the earlier session. And I get a sense that, you know, this is a sector that's slightly lost its mojo at the moment. And it has been, you know, there has been this kind of battering of reputational issues that have been going on for, I don't know, a couple of years, it probably feels like now. And I would like to see the sector kind of rise up with something new, something a new perspective, a new narrative, and a more confident narrative. Because I think at the moment it's just keeping its head down. And as Nick said, the fact that it's not saying anything about the CSR, you know, tells you the same kind of story, doesn't it? That it's not doesn't feel in a place to get back on the front foot. So,
do you think it's likely that that will happen?
What, that the sector will get back on the front foot?
Yeah, that it'll find its mojo.
Yeah, because do you know what? This is a sector that is jam-packed full of really clever people. And, you know, you just had to listen to, you know, the VC debate before this. And you know, I just thought, can't we just bottle, you know, some of that articulacy and the confidence with which, sparing Pamela's blushing on the panel as well, the confidence with which the Vice-Chancellor has talked about these really tricky issues. And I'm thinking, why can't we have some of that in the public domain? Because I think it would do us some good. And I think it's time that the sector, you know, I asked a question about sector leadership because I'm thinking, well, who's trying to pull the sector back up into a more confident position? And that's what I don't see happening at the moment.
Okay, Chloe, I'm interested to hear your thoughts about what you think the future of universities holds.
I think, like, I agree with Mary in terms of we need to find the mojo. I don't think we actually have a choice, because I think there are things that maybe we are leaving too late, whether it's mental health, and I think now is the time where things need to change, because otherwise there potentially will be no future.
Is Brexit anything that you think about as a student?
I think it is something we think about a great deal, but not necessarily think about, you know, we don't necessarily know what that would mean for us as students, and I think that would need to be conveyed more.
Pamela, we'll finish with you. What is the horizon showing for you?
Well, we are all battered and bruised and, you know, we're maybe not as vocal as we should be because we feel oppressed. You know, we've been beaten up regularly in the press. However, I think that actually does hide a huge amount of tremendous activity, whether it's on the mental health front, whether it's on contextualised admissions, widening participation, whether it's on leading research innovation globally. We need to get our act together to tell a coherent story. Let's get on the front foot with some great digital storytelling, which the whole sector can agree on, with some fabulous case studies. I think, you know, we were put on the back foot, and I think it was because of the Vice-Chancellor's salary debate. Yeah. I really do, and I think that we need leadership from the sector. Many Vice-Chancellors are showing restraint in their salary acceptances, whether or not their remuneration committees, which of course include students, certainly in ours.
What's going wrong when actually there are things going wrong?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So getting on the front foot is collecting those stories, being bold enough to keep telling them, and the future is going to be transnational, you know? Yes, we want people to come to this country, but not just bringing dollars, you know? We want them to bring their diverse cultures, to crack the monoculture, to, you know, foster a different debate where we're learning from Africa or learning from India, learning from Asia. What about China, for goodness sake? One of the powerhouses. So I think we need to be more collaborative, more vocal, more positive about what the future holds, and much more transnational, and not just obsess about money. If the funding model doesn't work, let's change the funding model. As you see, there's lots of clever people here, so I'm sure we can do it.
Great. Well, that's a good positive note for us to end on. Can you join me in thanking our panelists for a...
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.